head to farms, live there, and pick fruit. This was a call to young Australians last year who were looking for work. It was this attempt to fill the hole backpackers had left behind because they aren't here to work as fruit pickers. Hello, Avani Dias here. And on this episode of Hack, we're going to meet young farmers who are like, we are heartbroken because our crops are rotting on the vines without enough workers. They're pleading for the government to let in overseas workers because young Aussies haven't taken up the jobs. That's coming up soon on this podcast. And on the back end, a big celebrity case has created a conversation about cannibal kinks.
Hack. Tourism operators are demanding a lot more financial support after warnings Australia's international border could remain closed for most of this year.
On Triple J.
Remember jet lag, international holidays, visiting friends and family overseas? With the vaccine due to roll out soon in Australia, there was this hope we could be getting on international flights by the middle of the year. Today, though, a top health authority has said that's unlikely to happen until next year. And the tourism sector, which employs so many young people, is pleading for government support. Call me. Are you working in the tourism industry? Maybe you really want to head overseas. 1-300-055-36. I want to hear from you. Joe Lauder has this story.
It's one of the most rewarding jobs because after you take someone for a dive, usually their life is completely changed. Their mind is blown and they're like, oh my goodness, thank you. That was the best thing I've ever done.
Tanya Murphy has what a lot of people would consider a dream job. She lives in Cairns and works as a dive instructor on the Great Barrier Reef.
It never gets boring because the animals are always doing something different at every season. So every day I always might see something new that I've never seen before, which is absolutely amazing. But not only that, but also I absolutely love that we get to meet and interact with lots of really interesting people from all over the world normally.
But that was before COVID hit. Tanya says international tourists made up the majority of their customers before the pandemic.
Yeah, so I work on Sunlover Reef Cruises, and like most of the dive tourism boats off of Cairns, it was running 365 days a year before COVID. We were obviously in lockdown for a few weeks, and then after lockdown stopped, we were allowed to run again, but we were only running 3 days a week after that. Now the Christmas holidays are tapering off and we're approaching our February, March is traditionally our quiet season, even in a normal year.
Like so many people in far north Queensland, Tanya and her workmates are on JobKeeper, which is a government payment to businesses to keep people on the books during the pandemic. But JobKeeper's set to finish in March this year, and Tanya says lots of locals who work in tourism want it to continue.
Everyone in the tourism industry up here is really, really worried and definitely advocating and asking for the federal government to extend JobKeeper or to just change the threshold so that those businesses which have recovered will be able to continue recovering, but the ones which are still relying on international tourism are going to need to keep going with JobKeeper for a bit longer.
The big question is, when will we start seeing international tourists coming back? The different COVID vaccines are already being rolled out overseas, and Australians are going to start getting the jab from next month. That's made a lot of people think international travel could start back up pretty soon. But we shouldn't get our hopes up, according to the head of the health department, Brendan Murphy.
I think we'll go most of this year with still substantial border restrictions. Even, you know, if we have a lot of the population vaccinated, we don't know whether that will prevent transmission of the virus, and it's likely that quarantine will continue for some time.
The CEO of the Tourism and Transport Forum, Margie Osman, says the tourism industry is going to need more support through 2021 if the border stays closed.
We are going to need additional government support. There's no getting away from that. And I can't say more clearly, we can't recover without international borders being open, and we can't survive unless the state border issue is resolved.
She's warned that heaps of tourism businesses just won't survive if nothing changes.
What we're looking at is the possibility that when we open our borders again to international visitors, we won't have the attractions that makes Australia Australia. Many of them won't have been able to survive. And in addition to that, some of the most skilled workers in the tourism industry are making the choice to go elsewhere. So when it comes to visitor experience, we're going to need those people and we're not going to have them.
Today, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, was asked about this. He didn't commit to any changes or extra support for tourism yet, but he said domestic tourism will fill some of that gap.
Domestic tourism industry accounts for about 70 to 80% of the overall tourism industry in Australia, thereabouts. It varies by region, of course. And in this unusual time, Australians, who are big overseas travellers, are increasingly in a position and will want to more and more see their own country. So that's going to have its obvious impact.
Before working as a dive instructor, Tanya studied journalism, and she's gone back to working as a journalist part-time and still working part-time on the dive boat.
It's important to have another job at the moment, and a lot of my colleagues are doing the same thing, having a plan B. So we're hoping for the best, that tourism will recover, but preparing for the worst. That's just the lucky ones. I know lots of people who haven't been able to find any other job, and a lot of people won't be able to because so many jobs up here rely on tourism.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Joe Lauder with that story, and someone's texted, of course it's quiet, state politicians won't open the borders. Yeah, a lot of people saying that that is resulting in some of that lack of domestic travel within Australia as well. But I want to hear from you. Are you working in the tourism industry? How are you feeling about the prospect that we won't be getting overseas travellers till at least next year, according to some health authorities? 1300 055 36. Give me a call. Simon Westaway is from the Australian Tourism Industry Council. He represents workers in this space. Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So if this health advice is right, what would the lack of overseas travel for another year mean for the tourism industry?
We are in the midst of a global pandemic, and the numbers, you know, really are super serious globally. I mean, we're approaching 100 million cases, over 2 million dead on any level, even though the growth rates do appear to be start to be slowing in some of the big global hotspots. It's just all too hard, I reckon, with the international border. And yeah, we're just going to have to, as an industry, we're just going to have to work really closely with government. But it's good that there's been some frankness around where they see the border situation at, particularly on an international front.
Yeah, there was some talk, you know, Qantas was saying perhaps travel could start in July if you could prove that you were vaccinated. There were some industry people saying that it could be earlier than next year. But is there a model that could go ahead which would allow people to travel overseas and for Australia to let in international tourists?
We do actually have some international visitors coming through, and that's coming out of New Zealand. So we've got, if you like, a micro bubble or a one-way sort of outlet, if you like. So out of New Zealand since mid-October, the numbers, quite frankly, have been a bit of a dribble. There hasn't been that many people coming through that way because it can't be reciprocated at the moment. Like, we can't get across to New Zealand, be it to ski, to visit friends and relatives, or to, you know, have a holiday. So that may occur later this year. I am quite optimistic that I think we'll get two-way travel between Australia and New Zealand in some time during 2021. So that's really where it's sort of beginning and end. To sort of answer the cover off the back end of your question, I do think we can see possibly a couple of travel bubbles emerge in the back end of 2021. I think New Zealand's one that I've outlined. There's a possibility, you know, the South Pacific Islands, where they've got very, very low, in fact, no COVID cases. Yeah, so that's a good place to sort of, you know, transact people movement. And, you know, aspirationally, I'd love to see discussions happening with places like Singapore. But yeah, I just think where we're at with the virus at the moment, it's proving all too very difficult. And that 14-day quarantine, which the tennis players have been highlighting to us all in recent days, I mean, it's not that fun a thing to go through. So that's a big weight in the saddlebags, if you like, for wanting to travel in the first place.
Yeah, of course. It's obviously taking a lot longer than everyone thought. I mean, in terms of people working in tourism, we know that regional towns, plenty in North Queensland, for example, have been really affected by the lack of overseas visitors. How are young people in the tourism industry going at the moment from what you're hearing?
Yeah, younger people have really copped it. You know, they've lost hours, they've lost casual shifts. Some have been caught up in the JobKeeper arrangement. You know, it's been a real mixed bag, and you know, I understand it, feel it, and that's one of the things we're talking to government about at the moment, how we can do this better.
So how do you want to do it better? What can the government be doing to support you? Obviously, JobKeeper is due to end in March, but there are calls for that to be specified towards the travel industry until overseas borders open up. Is that feasible?
Yeah, look, we think it is. And look, I mean, JobKeeper is expensive public policy, but you know what? It's kept many businesses keep as many people on as they could, or certainly keep their core shift of people or core, you know, base of their employees until things get better. And as we've seen, as domestic borders have loosened, you know, people have got around and started to move about. You know, hospitality venues, once those restrictions started to come away in a safe way, we've been able to, you know, get more people in. You know, Victoria's starting to advertise for public gigs, if you like, around the state in coming weeks. So things can start to move and get better. So what we're saying is, in the regions, and particularly for the businesses that are really suffering at the moment but were sustainable before the virus, we just need a bit more time. I mean, we believe we need another 3 to 6 months of a, you know, targeted JobKeeper arrangement. For those businesses that want to participate, they can. For those that can see the other side, let's give them every incentive to do so, because I think it's much easier for them to be able to build back up rather than starting from afresh.
We're talking to Simon Westaway. He's from the Australian Tourism Industry Council, so representing workers in this major travel sector. Simon, you know, the Prime Minister has been speaking today. He's saying that Australians are wanting to see more of the country, that we like to go overseas and we obviously can't. And he is saying that that's making an impact, the fact that people are travelling internally. But is it actually filling the gap?
Well, it's not really filling the gap. It is filling part of the gap. And so I call it the 20-60-20 rule, if you like. So we're seeing around about 20% of our businesses or 20% of our regions that have done really quite well over recent times because they've had a captive market, particularly if they're in pretty close proximity to the major capitals of Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane, where the big population centres are, and capturing that day trip market or the overnight stay market. They've been able to recover pretty well. Where we've seen the big impact, though, is in the interstate travel and in the international market. So the international market delivered $50 billion of export dollars into the Australian economy each and every year. Now, that included international students who were travelling around. They included the backpackers, which contributed a number of billion of dollars of value. I mean, this money is not there anymore. And it's not just a commercial discussion. That changes the fabric of the way that many of our towns tick and how we get about things, even, you know, the collection of our food. A lot of the crop are picked by backpackers. So, yeah, look, it's a real challenge. And we don't want to be a handout industry, but we employ a lot of young Australians. You know, we employ 1 in 12 working Australians are either working full-time, casually, or in a part-time basis through tourism and hospitality. We think there's an opportunity for us to continue to have targeted support. And we're having good dialogue with government, but, you know, we've got to keep the pressure on as well.
All right, Simon, I think we'll all be, you know, trying to book some trips, you know, to support the industry. And it helps us as well. But thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Take care.
Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, that's Simon Westaway. He's from the Australian Tourism Industry Council. Let's speak to some of those young people in the tourism industry that Simon was referring to. Dom, you're a travel agent. How are you feeling about that news today that, you know, travel and overseas visitors couldn't start again potentially till next year?
Look, we take it in our stride. The amount of different rumours that we hear all the time every day changes every day, and it doesn't always end up eventuating the way they say it will. So we're quietly optimistic, but you know it's still tough news to hear from anyone. It also gets us busy on the phones with people wanting to for us to confirm or deny.
Yeah.
Information.
Yeah, and it's obviously always changing and it's difficult, but obviously this is coming from, you know, one of our top health authorities. But Dom, you know, we heard the Prime Minister speaking today. He's saying that travelling domestically has made a big impact on the industry. Are you finding that Australians are calling you trying to book trips within the country, or is that not happening?
Yeah, no, we're definitely getting some domestic inquiry, which is fantastic, and being able to help our clients along the way with that journey. I think people are still quite nervous with booking online and whatnot, just based on the border closures and the lack of transparent information and whatnot. So we are still getting really, fairly busy, but nothing like we were before. You know, it's going to take international to fill that, I guess, void or gap in our market. It is good to see that Aussies are getting out there and seeing their backyard and getting, you know, a fair amount of experienced help from us along the way, which is good. But it'll be a godsend once those borders open back up and we can actually start selling properly again.
For sure. Dom, thanks so much for your time. Brooke is on the line as well. Brooke, you're in Tassie. You work in the industry as well. What's it been like for you?
I think it's just been the uncertainty. Like, I'm a single mum with two boys and, you know, we rely on this season, and this is our peak tourism season in Tassie, and we're just relying on, you know, international and then obviously interstate, and then things are happening and popping up, and the fact that they've obviously closed, we're going to close the borders or stop the international travel, it's obviously a little bit of an uncertainty for all of us. Our shifts are based on influx as well. It's just not knowing. That's probably the worst. It's also been a little bit of a begrudging thing at work. Like, we're all very optimistic and we're a pretty supportive team of one another. But, you know, like for our boss as well, it's been horrible to see, you know, him and him being uncertain about what's happening. So, yeah, that's probably the scariest part about
Definitely.
It all, is just the not knowing. Yeah.
Yeah, and just quickly, we do need to move on, but do you feel like the government's committing to some support as the year goes on?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Tassie, Peter Gutwin's a legend. Obviously, with the tourism vouchers and stuff like that, that's been fantastic. But I think it's just about all of us coming together, partially whatever part of Australia you're from, and making sure that you're supporting local tourism.
All right. Brooke, thanks so much for calling in.
Hack.
We're just struggling to look for workers or find workers to be able to get those crops off.
On Triple J.
This is Hack on Triple J. I'm Avni Dias, and our next story relates to overseas borders as well, but it's potentially making our groceries more expensive. Remember how farmers were freaking out about not having backpackers coming in to help them with their harvest? Now their crops from the year have been rotting without enough people to do farm work. They're ditching millions of dollars of crops without overseas workers, mainly backpackers coming in. And many farmers are angry. Tennis players could come into the country from overseas for the Australian Open, but a plan to let in seasonal workers has not been accepted by the government yet. So there were calls for unemployed young people to take up this work. You may remember, it clearly hasn't filled the gap though. Call me. Have you been a fruit picker? Are you a farmer struggling through this? 1-300-055-36. Emma Germano is a young veggie farmer. She's in Gippsland, Victoria. She's also the head of the Victorian Farmers Federation. Emma, thank you for coming on the show. How has the season been for you?
We got off to a bit of a rocky start because we were waiting for seasonal workers to arrive from Vanuatu, and we had lots of promises from the Victorian government that they were arranging a quarantine program for us in order to get workers here by the 1st of December. I thankfully have gotten some workers that have come through the Northern Territory. The Northern Territory state government managed to get a protocol up to do this hotel quarantine. Basically on behalf of a lot of growers around Australia and not just Northern Territory, but we just need bigger numbers. And we're starting to see it bite. We're starting to see those crops being ploughed in and really now hearing the reports of how great the losses are. And it's only going to get worse as the 2021 harvest period in Victoria goes on.
Emma, there was calls, you know, around June last year. We've been covering it a fair bit on Hack for young people to take up this work because backpackers weren't around as much. Has that happened?
We have seen an increase in the number of Aussies and young Aussies on our farms, which is really encouraging. But we knew that in order to basically plug a hole that was about 90,000 people in that workforce between backpackers and seasonal workers from the Pacific, that it was going to be a big call trying to get all these Aussies out onto farms in a really short period of time. There's lots of reasons why that can be difficult for Australians. And we're basically saying we need all of the tools in the toolbox. So Aussies, absolutely, please give us back the migrant workers that we need and get us protocol system for hotel quarantine. And let's just not take for granted that we're simply talking about the food that we eat.
Yeah, Emma, there is a plan in regards to that. You know, calls for 26,000 people to come in from overseas into Victoria specifically. There are different calls in other states, obviously. How do you propose that should work?
So actually, there's been a number of different proposals that have been put to the Vic government. So whether that was on-farm quarantine, and we're not talking about just randomly bringing in workers and saying, go off and find your own jobs. We're specifically talking about the restart of the seasonal worker program. Those workers go to pre-approved employers. So you have to have accommodation that's been checked out by the Department of Jobs federally. You've got to make sure that you've got pastoral care arrangements. These workers know exactly where they're going and to farms that have been pre-approved. So there are some ideas out there that we want migrant workers because they're cheaper. They're certainly not, actually. There's a lot of money that's invested in ensuring that those workers can come in from overseas. But essentially, we've said we could do on-farm quarantine. We could set up a farm hub. That was one of the models put forward. The Vanuatuan government even stepped in and said that they'd be happy to do quarantine in country and have pre-approval checks for COVID before the workers departed, and with dedicated planes that would not stop anywhere or anything like that. So from a risk perspective, we've put forward many, many options, but there's just no political will to make it happen.
Trent from Mildura has called in. So you've actually worked as a fruit picker.
Oh, hi, Odie. How are you?
Good. How's it going?
Good, thanks, Dale. Yeah, I'm from Mildura and I've done fruit picking on and off my entire life, and I can tell you exactly why there's no Aussie kids filling those roles, and it's as simple as this. They can go and work at Coles or Woolies and make twice the amount of money in better conditions. The government needs to step up and offer those farmers some support in order to make those jobs more lucrative for Aussie kids.
Emma Germano from the Victoria Farmers Federation, what do you say to Trent's point there? Because we are getting so many texts to that effect. You know, someone says maybe if the farmers paid a real wage, they might get locals. It isn't rocket science. And of course, there have been several reports and findings of systemic underpayment on farms of these workers. Is there a perception that you're not going to get well paid doing this work?
Oh, 100%. I'm not going to shy away from that. And all I would say, particularly to Trent, is those farms that you've been on, if you weren't making the award wage or your piece rate wasn't correct, then those farmers should be dobbed into the regulator. We've got the Fair Work Ombudsman there for that point, because I find it really frustrating as a grower who pays the right number of dollars to my workers, and you know, my workers love working on my farm, and I actually have a mix of Aussies and seasonal workers. It really gives me the irrits that people are underpaying, because it means that I'm not it's not a fair competition between me and the grower who, you know, we've heard stories of $3 an hour and things like that. Nothing makes a grower who's doing the right thing more angry than to know that some of those growers have done that.
Trent, what do you say to that?
Oh, well, 100%. I mean, it's like any industry, there's always the good and the bad. But rurally speaking, the consciousness of young people is the conditions are too hard for the outcome. And most kids will go work at Coles or Woolies or something like that instead, you know?
All right, Trent, thanks so much for calling in. I want to go to Rob Hayes. He's from a non-for-profit. It's called Madec. And basically it hooks up growers with workers. And, you know, we spoke to you, Rob, last year about encouraging young Australians to get into some of this work. How have you found that? Has there been a take-up?
There has been some success, yes. We've definitely seen more young Australians working in horticulture. But as Emma said, we would certainly love to see more.
Yeah, there was a lump sum offered, $6,000, if you were to take up this kind of work, but only 350 Australians have actually taken up that program. I mean, what needs to happen to increase young Australians getting into this industry if we're not going to see overseas workers for a while until the government commits to it?
I think some of the good stories, you know, people are finding that they are having good experiences with horticulture work. I know there's a lot of stories and there has been some exploitation and underpayment. What we're finding this year with workers harder to find is that a lot more growers are paying above award rates. They have more generous rates and they're doing a lot more to look after workers and to attract workers.
Rob, thanks so much for your time. Emma, just quickly before we let you go, you know, there were calls very late last year from the unions to make it the award rate, the minimum wage. Do you support that? Should there be mandatory payments of that nature to ensure young people get into this work?
So firstly, the horticulture award wage for an unskilled, so if you start on a farm on the first day and you're being paid as a casual worker, you should be making $24.80 an hour, which is actually really well above some of those other jobs that we're talking about in regards to hospitality or working in supermarkets or things like that. The piece rate agreement is still based on that $25 an hour or $25-ish an hour. So what it says is that
that the average competent worker, so if you're an average picker and we look at the whole field of workers that are out there and how much they've picked in a given amount of time, and we go, the average person has to be able to make more than 15% above the award wage. So actually what it's supposed to do is incentivize people that they can actually make more than that hourly rate. The problem that we've seen is that's transpired into some people making $5 or $10 an hour. But what's really interesting is that those migrant workers actually far prefer to have the piece rate in place rather than an hourly rate. So on my farm, when we pick potatoes, we do that all by piece rate, and the workers will absolutely not pick potatoes unless they're making about $60 an hour, and they absolutely make it. So what we need to see is those people that are doing the wrong thing, they need to be reported, they need to be either removed from the industry or educated as to what's acceptable, because it's just no good for anyone when Aussies think that Aussie farms aren't great places to work on. And, you know, a bad story sells a lot easier than a good story, but we've definitely got to get those good stories out there.
For sure. Emma Germano from the Victoria Farmers Federation. We do need to move on, but I really appreciate you coming on Hack.
Hack.
Those texts allegedly including fantasies of cannibalism and sexual assault.
On Triple J.
Right, there's a lot happening in the world, but I was scrolling and I saw a story that American actor Armie Hammer is a cannibal. Look, a warning, this is some pretty graphic stuff. We'll be talking about it for the rest of the show. But Armie Hammer is an actor. He's in Call Me By Your Name, Hotel Mumbai, The Social Network, heaps of films. And he's, being branded as an actual human-eating cannibal because a number of Instagram DMs were made public. They appeared to show him admitting to this, asking for violent sexual fantasies. Then multiple women have come forward with similar stories. They say they think those screenshots are legit. Others say they've experienced non-consensual behavior by him. Armie Hammer has said in a statement that he's not going to respond to the, quote, bullshit claims. And obviously we don't condone unconsensual behavior, but putting the Armie Hammer case aside, this has created a much bigger question. Is it inherently abusive or predatory to send messages like this? Dr. Lauren Rosewarne is from the University of Melbourne. She's been researching this. Thank you for coming on the show, Lauren. Obviously, the Armie Hammer case, it's very murky. A lot of he said, she said, but putting that aside, you know, the fantasy around this cannibal fetish, tell us about that.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I think we need to be a bit careful because I think our gut instinct often for fantasies that are extreme and violent and often not on our usual radar have a gut instinct response that we're grossed out or that we think it's violent or we think that there must be some law against it. And I think we just need to be careful that we don't let our tastes dictate what could be consensual behaviour between two adults.
I guess the thing here to point out, though, is it's one thing messaging about these fantasies and actually following through. Obviously, there have been legal repercussions for this kind of thing. So, you know, how do you kind of draw that line when a lot of people listening might be thinking this is really disturbing?
Mm. And I wrote an article about that this week, looking at this idea of calling him a cannibal versus somebody who has cannibal fantasies, because fantasies aren't against the law, but actually eating someone is. So that idea, that distinction, I think we need to be quite careful about, because this is one of those things that, you know, distinguishes a person from something they might enjoy in their private life versus something that will end you up in, you know, a court situation, as you mentioned, has happened in the past.
Yeah, and the big thing here is obviously consent, right, even when it comes to messaging.
Absolutely. This idea of there are so many different ways to abuse and be abused. And if your partner, you know, be it just somebody on the text, you know, the other end of a text message or an Instagram message, if they're not into it, you need to stop. It's not okay. But we need to also accept sometimes both parties are into stuff that you might personally find gross.
It's interesting, as you say, the commentary around Armie Hammer, and we are going to hit the news really soon, but there's a lot of shaming around it. And of course, there are concerns that it could not be consensual, but purely looking at that cannibal fantasy aspect, why is there so much shaming here?
Because we are a culture that has a tendency to use one thing that a person might be into sexually to define them as a person. We don't do it with anything else. We don't say, oh, you're a squash player, or, you know, you like eating lasagna. But when it comes to sex, we use this as a way to demonize and judge people. And that's something I think we need to be really careful about. Just because you find it yuck doesn't mean everyone will.
All right. Dr. Lauren Rosewarne from the University of Melbourne, you've been researching this, you've written a book about it. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Hack on Triple J.
Hey, if that did bring up anything for you, don't forget you can call 1-800-RESPECT. That is all we've got time for on Hack, but don't forget you can follow us on Instagram and Facebook. I'd love to hear from you as well if you've got any ideas of things that we should be looking into. I'll see you on the next episode.